The following is tape two of an unrehearsed interview with Mr. J.B. Johnson by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the home of Mr. Johnson in Williamsburg, Kentucky on July 19th, 1978 at 11 o'clock a.m. Now, Mr. Johnson, before I got the other tape, we were talking about the early pioneers into Whitley County and the possessions that they brought with them. Is there anything else you would like to say about the possessions that the early pioneers brought? Anything else about the possessions the early pioneers brought with them?
Well, fundamentally, and the first thing they brought along with them was a cooking pot and hooks. Everybody had to have a built a fire and swung their kettle. You've seen that old type, swung their kettle on a rod's figure. At least they brought two of those pots, a small one and a large one. They brought animals and they brought shears to cut the wool with. They brought shears to cut wool. They brought pot hooks, that you know what the pot hooks are, and that's the very first thing that they had to have. They brought plows too, what we call bull-tongue plows, just one furrow, one horse bull-tongue plow. They brought those things, along with the other things I've mentioned.
Well, now, while we're still on the early pioneers, did Thomas Walker or Daniel Boone either come through Whitley County?
Yes. Oh, yes. Thomas Walker, have you been up there at the park?
Yes.
Been to the park. Mm-hmm. Thomas Walker, that was the Finley was ahead of Walker, you know, coming in here. Thomas Walker, he deserves great credit. He came to the park, he came to through the gap and down, and their party stopped at what they call Swan Pond or Swan Lake, down about 4 miles below Barberville. And they erected a cabin there. I used to be able to recite everybody was in the party, but I can't remember it now. The old replica of the cabin is there yet, that restored and their idea of it. I have seen the old one before this modern restoration was made. But when I had to go right by that park, going from my home in Whitley County, which is just at the line of Knox, to Barberville, that park was right on the road. And I passed by it many times as a kid, but I never had sense enough to know that it was important. Never did go down to it and examine it. That's the old Dr. Walker first house in Kentucky. To me at that time, I was so ignorant that it didn't click that this is important. I wished so many times I had gone down and looked at the old one, but all I saw it was from the road up down to the park. The road was above the park, and I don't know whether the present reproduction of it is as facsimile or not. I just don't have any idea, but I've seen the old cabin.
You mentioned the Revolutionary War, that pioneers came in to Whitley County after the war and just
yes.
before.
Yes. Yeah. Largely, they were some here, but I can't tell you who they were. I don't think the history records But they begin, after the Revolutionary War, they begin to pour into the valley much faster.
Now, were these veterans from the war that came in, or who were they?
Yeah, many veterans. One of my grandparents on each side of the house was among them. Yeah, there were many veterans came in.
Well, now, we'll move on to the actual formation of Whitley into a county. Now, you said this was, I think, in 1818?
Whitley was formed out of Knox County in 1818. Knox County was, as I remember it, as a county, I believe it had maybe they were first just three counties in Kentucky, or no. And I believe that that was in exactly 1800. I know Kentucky was made a state in 1817 and, wait a minute, 1792.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how did they decide on the name for the county? Who is it named after?
William Whitley. Famous landowner and Indian fighter. He has credit for killing Tecumseh along with it, with Johnson. what is Johnson's name? He claimed Isaac Shelby some things that were killing Tecumseh, you know. That's the famous Indian battle.
Well, speaking of Indians, now, do you know anything about Indians in Whitley County? Did they ever have an Indian problem here?
Oh, yes. Now, the pest house that I told you about up here in Copper Creek, the John Tye House, there was a killing there, and that's rather famous. It's set out in Collins' History of Kentucky, some great detail, Indian fight with the Thai family. Yeah, that I don't know what the date of that was. I think it was before the Civil War. I don't mean Civil War, I mean a revolution. But I've forgotten now. I've got all those histories downstairs in my life. Hobby room, but I can't remember.
I will move on to some customs of the pioneers. Did you ever hear any talk of early customs that the pioneers had?
Early on?
Early customs of the pioneers, like what did they do about funerals, we'll say? What was their practice for a death?
I don't know.
You never heard that, okay. Well, what about things like house raisings and barn raisings? Did you ever hear anything?
Oh, yes. I've attended a many a one myself. They're not pioneer days. They come on down. Oh, yes, the way they built houses and built barns and just got new grounds was the natural way. The neighbors would all go in and build John Smith a house, fix it up, and then they'd say, well, now Jim Jones, he's got no house, or one he's got enough to live in, and they'd agree, in other words, they'd build a house or a barn, or especially when somebody got sick and wasn't able to do anything, which is frequent, of course. They would go in and clean up a mountain, put out a crop for a man while he was getting well. By the time he got well, the crop would be ready to be raised. And corn shuckings, and barn and corn shuckings, and bean pullings and bean shellings and all those things. They were great fun. I used to look forward to fall in the year when a manner to invite his neighbors in to shuck corn. And we'd have a big dinner, a big chicken and dumpling dinner. And I danced that night. Now, some of the religious people wouldn't dance, but you could go into swinging games, but they didn't want you to dance. There was that manners getting too close to the other fellow's wife.
Well, how long did these things continue?
It was religious. That was a religious thing, yeah.
How long did these things continue, like the barn raising? You said you went to some.
Oh, yes, I've been. Well, I can remember going to one after I began to practice law here in Huntington County in 1926. I don't think it was 26. I think it was a year later, maybe. I can remember going to one even that late. But when I was a kid, from 1910, by the time I was about 13 years old, until I left here, we'd have three or four every fall somewhere. We had two or three places we had regular had them. We knew where they were. They maybe knew that we got them. Ruth Rollins always had a barn, or a corn shucking. Jim Johnson always had a corn shucking. So, let's see. Frank Sharp, they had corn shuckings. I was trying to have those that just always had them. Rar Smith, Rar U.P. Smith. I tell my children, one of my boys is a physician at Ashland, and I gave him the old farm where I was reared, or where I was born, because he wanted it. He asked me, said, "Now, Daddy, I want this farm." And I told him I'd give it to him, and I gave him. He'd got a deed to it. But I telling him those things, and he just thinks it just strikes him in unbelief that people used to have those things, but such as barn raising and corn shuckings and things that kind. He just said that we don't have those things at all anymore. They're just completely out.
Well, you've mentioned like your son being a doctor, so we'll talk about early medicine. What were some of the early remedies for disease?
Oh, boy. I'd have to think and make a list. Well, we had all kinds of diseases, and many contagious diseases, like you take such places as measles and whooping cough. They just occurred everywhere. They started when everybody wanted their children to have whooping cough and measles before, and when they were little, because if you waited, got grown, it was much severe, much more potentially dangerous. But we had Penerile tea, birch tea, I'm thinking about hot, you know, birch tea, Penerile tea, for colds and coughs, mullein tea, you know what mullein is?
No.
It's a great big thick heavy leaf, something about that long, about that big. You see it on the fall of the year on some of the farms here. I don't. It was a mean taking tea. That's from measles. And then we had barks, like a fruit gum bark for flux. And we had sheep dung tea for sheep, I mean for measles. I never did take any, but I know my sister didn't want to, but she did. Yeah, it the teas we had, sassafras, you've heard of sassafras. Sassafras, though, was taken more to give you blood at the spring of the year than it was as a remedy for anything. It just gave you blood and strengthened your blood. Kind of looked like, you know, when it's colored like it is, it kind of looks like blood. I don't know whether that's reason it got the name or not. These old time granny women, we called them, that took care of the girls when they had no doctors. In those days, they had no doctors. I can remember the first baby that was ever born on Meadow Creek was attended by a doctor.
When was that?
As Dr. Leland Terrell did, he took care of a woman by the name of Grace Johnson. Now, there had been before that, but that's the one I can first remember. Grace was one of the girls that started to be reared with me. She was my first cousin. I'd say that was about 19. And, 8 or 9, somewhere back there.
I will move off of customs and go on moving up a little later in time. I heard a story, or just saw it someplace, that there was a silver find at Cumberland Falls around 1850.
What?
Silver was supposed to have been found around Cumberland Falls. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know what history records. You can read in Collins' history, I guess it is, somebody's history. Those people that found that silver were New Yorkers. And there's two theories of it, or at least there is in people's mind here what I have learned to talk about. One of them is that the New Yorker thought that they found something. I don't know what it was. And that they used it as a promotion idea to get a lot of people to settle there. And they perhaps themselves knew it wasn't silver. And they were going to get a lot of people down there, and then they're going to harness the falls and for production of, see, in those days they ground wheat and meal for production of the wheat and corn and meal, and put up a mill, flour and meal mill. Now that's one theory that I've heard advanced more than once. The other is that they thought that it was, and they didn't know better until they took it back east to an assess and had it analyzed. Now, I don't know which is right. One thought it was a fart to attract a lot of people there, and then they'd be there and have nothing doing. They'd build a couple of mills. There's going to be one. The way I hear it, one on one side of the river and one on the other You've seen the falls?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see, it's largely a stream right in the middle goes off, you know that. It's going all the time. And there's one put the mill on one side for wheat and a mill on the other side to grind corn. Of course, that was quite a problem in those days, is getting corn ground. That was quite a problem. I can remember when I had to ride 6 miles over in the country to go to a water mill on the Cumberland River up at McNeil's Mill in Knox County. I've done it time after time. We had 2 water mills on the river, one here at Cumberland Falls. I don't mean Cumberland Falls, I mean at Loudoun. 12 miles up the river. It's just been out a few years. At McNeil now, Dam, which is the way the river runs about 20 miles on the direction of Barbara, called McNeil. It's a bigger dam, bigger mill. It works for corn. And as far as I know, that mill, that dam is still going. I guess I may be wrong. I guess it's out, maybe. It's some trouble to keep the old mill dam in repair. A hard tide that gets over so often, the logs, debris, and so forth get lodged on top of that mill. And sometimes they'll stay there all summer or winter. Unless another tide comes in and pulls it off. But it riding there breaks those logs that's down in the river. See, they're put down in the river like that and come up here to make your dam. And it breaks them, tears them loose, and then you'll get a big hole in the dam. And it's awful hard to repair that hole in the middle of a pretty good river. And it is a pretty good river at that point.
And since you mentioned the mill, just what were some of the early industries or in, you know, ways of making a living here in Whitley County?
Well, the two earliest ways of organized industry as we see it now, of course, was the coming of the railroad in 1817 and 84. That, and before that, they go hand in hand. Before that, of course, was the development of mines. Those are the two things. Now, they had, before even the mines were developed, we had lumber. We had no roads all on. Up this valley, there's been some tremendous lumber. I mean, trees, oak, poplar, pine, all kinds. Well, there's just a great variety of which you have to have in building. Has been there. And there's all, the sawmill is, as compared with many things, it's kind of old thing. The time was, you know, when you sawed with a hand or up. And at first, my grandfather's house was made out of that kind of lumber. Put a log on right and sit it up and down like that. And get a little ladder. Each build a platform, or get a ladder. Build a platform is better to get the sawman up to it, and you'd have to have several platforms to lower it. See, go up. See, they'd put the log up like that at about a 35-foot angle. Here'd be the bottom of it, and up here'd be the top of it. And men would have to start at the top up here, anchor that log with in clamps and saw down. That was slow to saw because you'd have to adjust your part where you were so long, but that's the way they saw. My granddaddy's house was built out of that type of sawed lumber. Now, in other words, the most important thing always has been finding a place to eat, I mean to sleep, some place to live. And that thing, I can remember, I worked on it. We used to cut to the logs in the mountain, snake them down or haul them to a common point. So maybe 100s, even thousands of them. Connected. We had two places we used to always collect them and raft them. And when the river tide got high enough, put the raft out, put them in the river, and at the right time when the river was high, you got to have two things: enough water behind you to bring it on down, not let it stop somewhere where water run out, and raft those logs. Sometimes a raft would be as long as a street. And it usually take two men or three men riding that log, that raft of logs. That raft of logs would carry about 150 to 200 logs, depending on the log size. They could manage that many. And a good raftsman could, by using his raft pole, keep it in the middle of the river and not let it run against trees and break up or something like that. That's the way, when I was a kid, that's the way the logs went down the river. The mill was here at Williamsburg. Sawmill, one here, right out there at Savoy, just at the edge of town. And the other mill was down the river at Watch Creek, mouth of Watch Creek, a couple of miles down the river. And the first means of transportation we had of logging, getting logs in it, was water. But then, of course, when railroads come along, of course, trucking is very modern, you know that. I can remember when railroads and highways, you can't haul many logs on the old-fashioned wagon, not trucks like we have now. You can find, sometimes you've got them, you see them, sometimes a dozen logs. They're small. The old logs that they were, they wouldn't log anything under 18 inches in diameter. Just how they wouldn't log it. Wouldn't log it. But now if we get one 18 inches, we've got a good log.
Pardon me, I'm going to turn the tape over. Of an interview with Mr. J.B. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, before I turn the tape over, you were talking about the railroad, and you said that it came in 1784. Now, did you mean 1784 or 1884?
Oh, I meant 1884.
Well, now, just what effect did the coming of the railroad have on Whitley County?
Well, it just industrialized it. It just, the mines could go to work, the lumber industry went up. It's just a means of transportation of the grower, owner of the logs, getting it to a place where you get money out of it. It just and it not only affected people here that could work, but all the people back on the creeks and valleys that worked in the logger, getting it cut and haul to the water line and rafting it and bringing it to Williamsburg. That was a great job, so it gave employment to many people for many different reasons.
Now, you mentioned the mines. Has there been a lot of coal mining in
Yes.
Whitley County?
Oh, yes. Tremendous amount of coal mining. The earliest mine was up here at Redbird is what they called it. It's near Jellicoe. It's in about two or three miles of the Tennessee line. That Redbird was the earliest mine. Then one here at Williamsburg that was called Mount Morgan. It is very early. One over at Mountain Ash. It is called Mountain Ash. That's about midway between here and the state line. At 8 miles to the south.
Well, now, is there any other early industries that came to Whitley County that you'd like to talk about? You've mentioned the lumber and the coal and the railroad, and then we've talked about farming earlier.
Yes. Well, farming at the present time, particularly cattle growing, is the thing that sustains the county more, I guess, right now than anything else. These farms are not very productive so far but they produce hay and grass, and the farmers have learned they can clear up these hillsides and take the whatever timber there is off and then plow it up and cultivate it, put it in grass and raise cattle. That's the thing that right now I'd say is the prime thing in the county is cattle to raise.
Well, I want to move off the industry now to the Civil War. What stories or what do you know of the Civil War here in Whitley County? Were there any battles?
Civil War? Well, yes, we had. We were on the borderline here. There's no use to go into the thing very deep historically. President Lincoln was very anxious to keep Kentucky neutral. As far as I know, there was no real effort ever to bring him into the southern side. Now, the Confederates had especially strong out central Kentucky in that area and western Kentucky. But in this area, they remained neutral and sympathetic to the Union. And that's one reason they tell us that this section through here is now Republican, because it was a Democrat stronghold. These mountain people have been there. Freedom, they like freedom, and they followed the Jefferson's doctrine until the Civil War, and they couldn't embrace, they didn't need slaves of what little industry and things they had. Slaves was needed for the type of work like growing tobacco and things of that kind. And they didn't need them and didn't use them. I can remember when you couldn't find tobacco growing in this county. And as a result, they lost their allegiance to the Jeffersonian doctrine and predominantly now are Republican. That was caused by the economic need more than anything else.
Well, were there actually never any slaves in here? Were there never any slaves in Whitley County?
Yes, there were a few slaves and slaveholders. There were slaves out here at Wofford, at the Berry family, the Berrys. They had slaves. They gradually freed them. I wouldn't say they freed all of them, but they did free many of them. They were two large families out there. Berry's was perhaps the largest, and the I've forgotten. We buried not long ago decorated and put a monument to his grave not long ago out there, but I can't think of his name. Broughton. It's not that. That kings who lived in this community here, they had slaves. There's more than that, but I can't think of the name now.
Well, now what about battles? Were there any actual Civil War battles in Whitley County?
There were two skirmishes here. The Union Army undertook to and did travel from down in Tennessee near Knoxville up the Clear Fork River into Whitley County here at Jellicoe, and there up to here, Williamsburg, and turned west. They met resistance when they got up here. They met a lot of personal resistance, not an organized army, but just personal resistance. Unorganized, I guess you would call it, whatever it is a fellow's called when he gets his gun and gets out behind a tree and shoots the fellow, and not organized, he's his own captain. What is that? And when they got here, that was Kirby Smith's army, General Kirby Smith. They turned west and went across Jellicoe Mountain, and they did it, I understand, on the kind of the thing they thought that a Union force was coming south to meet them here, and they were trying to flank them and let them pass in front of them. They got over to McCreary County, and they hung two or three people, hung two people to an apple tree. They did some depredations and mean things. And at about the McCreary County, about where 27 turns back into Tennessee, they turned back into Tennessee, and they didn't know where the line was, of course, is in the woods. And down in Tennessee, close Winfield, Tennessee, they had a skirmish. Unknowingly, they did some damages to the Southern Army. They got mixed up. Pretty easy to get mixed up in that woodland and that country. Even until very recently, there's just a solid wood. It's some roads in there now. They had that skirmish down there. Now, we have as a memorial to Civil War the only woman that participated in the Civil War in her own right. There's a plaque in our courthouse yard. Have you seen it?
No.
Plaque in the courthouse yard here at Winterberg telling what she did. She lived here. She lived in Tennessee at the time. She had been attacked in Tennessee. And she draws a pension. The only woman of the Civil War that drew a pension was Aunt Julia Markham. I knew her quite well. She's not been dead over, 20 years, I guess. Maybe 30. She's buried here in Williamsburg, over at the Highland Cemetery. And she, For her, she lived here. She would had been a school teacher in her young days down in Tennessee, and she lost an eye in the battle that she had. And she, for her, a Civil War soldier that's fought on the side of the South was an old rebel. She used to attend and be the biggest applauder there was at a Republican rally.
If there's nothing else you'd like to say about the Civil War, I'd like to move on to just the turn of the century, you know, the early 20th century, or the early 1900s here in Whitley County, before we run out of time. I'd like to talk about the coming of the automobile and paved roads. Now, when did people first begin to get cars here?
I understand the first automobile ever I saw was in 1904. It was owned by Dr. Archer here in Williamsburg. He was a dentist. And I was in Williamsburg. We'd come down. We didn't get to go, come to town but once or twice a year. No use to come except when you paid your taxes. And I had an uncle, George Johnson, a lawyer here, and an uncle, Jim Sharp, also a lawyer that lived here. And they always wanted me to come down. I might say they always told me I ought to get an education, too. And now let me say this while I'm saying that. It was Jim Sharp more than anybody else. He was perhaps the outstanding lawyer of this whole country. He was a brother to my grandmother who reared me. And he took a lot of interest in me because he'd grown up with my father. And he'd come up to see his sister and his mother who lived up in the country. He up there one time, and I came back with him in a buggy. And he said, "Well, I'm going to take you over." He lived here in town. "I'm going to take you over and introduce you to the court in the morning." I was tickled to death. I didn't know what it was like. First court I ever saw in session. Fellow named Black, a very genteel old man, was judge. And I went over to court with him the next morning, and I didn't know how it functioned or anything. They called court and started just in the old-fashioned way. And the first thing they did was go around to all the lawyers and ask them if they had motions to make. And they were, some of them did and some of them didn't. Got down to my Uncle Jim. And he got up. He was a very quiet, reserved type of fella. But he had more motions than all the lawyers put together, at least I thought so. He stood and talked about this case, that case, that case, that case, and what it was there. I learned a lot about what there's lawing about. And he wanted to file a demur in this and an answer in this and a cross petition in this case, whatever it was he wanted to file. And he got through. J.B. Johnson said he was going to be a lawyer. I just liked it, that never left me. Never let me. What was it I started to talk?
We were talking about the first automobile.
Huh?
We were talking about the first automobile. The first car.
Oh, yeah. Now, only a few rich could have an automobile at that time.
You said Dr. Archer had the first car.
Dr. Archer. Well, he was a doctor. In addition to that, he married Dr. Gatliff's daughter. And Dr. Gatliff was the man who operated most of three of the mines in the county. So, naturally, he got in first on. A fellow named Delaney owned an automobile, and there's another one, and then my Uncle Jim Sharp. I think he was the fourth fella that owned an automobile. But I looked at it, and I wish I could get in it and ride, but there, I didn't. But Uncle Jim wrote, Dolores is coming to see us in 2 or 3 weeks or whatever it was, on a Sunday. And he drove that car to Meadow Creek. How he got there, I don't know. He didn't get it back. They took it back with a pair of mules and broke down. But he drove that car to Meadow Creek and on down to Aunt Laz's. That was his sister. On down, he drove that car. I'd say this much. Meadow Creek perhaps is the easiest road in the county except Jellicoe Creek after you got across the mountain. But you had to get across the Jellicoe Mountain before you could hardly use it. But Meadow Creek perhaps, it's a little bit more level, not so many high hills. Several little short hills, but not. And he drove that to Meadow Creek a few times. And it was a novelty. But I'd say they didn't have many automobiles here until 1919. They built some little roads here and there and somewhere. Dirt roads that were not hard surface, but you could use them in summertime if it didn't rain. About 1920. Now, when I was on Poplar Creek in 1918, there wasn't a car. When I taught school at the head of Arch Creek, there wasn't a car on Poplar Creek. I can remember when the first one came to Meadow Creek, Dr. Smith, who lived over at Rockhold, 8 miles away, brought it, and I would say that car he had in about 1915 or 16, he got an old Model T Ford car, and he could get down that creek, but not in wintertime. I don't think he ever tried it in wintertime, it was just a mud road. But in summertime, he got down Meadow Creek and we didn't get a good road from here to Corbin until 1923. A good road from here to the state line until 1929. South. We got a good road about halfway from here, there, down to Saxon. I mean one that was hard service the year round. We have developed the automobile and used it very convenient, of course. And everybody wants to copy somebody else. Lots of fellows bought cars that had no business buying them. They didn't have the money, but they wanted them and they got them. But they never were. Very useful until we got the road from Lexington to Knoxville hard surfaced. And that, now believe this or not, that happened while I was in school at Lexington in 1924, 25 or 26. I remember well. They made quite a to-do about it. A bus went from Lexington to Knoxville and back. And they had pictures, and they'd had a photographer with them all the way. They'd show what they'd go, everything. I was in school there, but what it is, 24 or 25 or 26, I can't fix that date. After got a road from Knoxville to Lexington that you could travel on. They came pretty fast, because in those days we were rather prosperous around here. We had mines going, railroads were going full blast, and the automobile came into its own about 1926. They began to get some gravel roads out in the country but we've got some of those roads yet. You can't get over.
this road you mentioned from Lexington to Knoxville, do you have any idea how long it would have taken in the 20s to travel from Lexington to Knoxville on this road?
Well, let me put it this way. We went from here to Bergen. You know where Bergen is in Kentucky? Mm-hmm. It's right at Harrodsburg, 2 or 3 miles from Harrodsburg. We went from here to Bergen in 1922 or 3. I guess it was 22. And it took us early, leaving here early in the morning. It was a foggy morning. I remember we left here early in the morning, fairly early. We had a hook automobile. I was living with my aunt then. We had a hook. Well, she had a brother living in Bergen. We got to Mount Vernon at noon. We had lunch with us. Got out and ate lunch beside the road. And we got to Bergen at about 6 o'clock. We left here about 6. It took about 12 hours to go less than 100 miles. Most of it was gravel road, but not all of it. Now, there were some sections down along Ocasio River that was just dirt road. We always thought if we could go from here to Lexington, when I can remember well, that's exactly 100 miles from here to Lexington. Exactly. But the old road was 124. With an I-75 built. And we always went from here to Lexington, and we thought we were making good time. If we made 33 miles an hour, that took it 3 hours. We go now, of course, in 2.
We'll move off of the automobile to the coming of electricity. Now, when did electricity come to this county?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the date of electricity, but I'll tell you one thing. The first time I ever saw it was the time I told you I came to Uncle Jim Sharp's back about 1906 or 7. About 6 or 7. He had it at the office, I remember, in bed. I remember he showed me how to turn the light on and off when we went to bed that night. That's the first time I don't know how long it had been here, but that was it was about 1908, because it wasn't the year my grandfather died. He died in 1904. It was after 1904.
Well, do you know what type of effect this had on people? You know, how did people react to this electricity?
Well, many of them didn't want it, and especially when they began to cook with it. Women often were afraid of it, right? They'd get electrocuted. They were hesitant. I've heard women say they didn't have an electric stove because they was afraid of electric. I don't know how long that lasted. I'd say that fear had disappeared around here by 1920. I'd say it had disappeared, but that's a guess. But I remember for several years, talked to a woman about electric stove. Nuh-uh. She was just afraid of it. Said she'd hit the wrong thing and electrocute.
Well, what about indoor plumbing? When did that come to the area?
What?
Indoor plumbing.
Plumbing?
Uh-huh.
Well, let me say it this way. I never saw, there was no such a thing as indoor plumbing. The introduction to indoor plumbing and so forth was when even they could do this out in the country. When the farmers could take a barrel and put it upstairs, pump water in it, you know. Now, that was the introduction. But I'd say, I can remember the first families that ever did that on Meadow Creek. I was a great big boy. the first ones that ever did it, but that wasn't any electricity, of course, there. But it was about in the teens, I'd say it in the teens, but the day I couldn't fix, that I saw the first fixed up thing at a neighbor, over near the farmers, good farmers, industrious people, and they had that down. I can remember that. But that was pretty soon followed by that, by the way, didn't have sewers, had pits, that did. Followed pretty soon by electric plumbing and sewers. I can remember the first sewer that was ever out in the country. Man had a lot of trouble with it. Didn't know how to fix it and build it, you know. Had an awful lot. That's in the 20s. The modern conveniences that we've had now, electric lights, running water, sewage, all that, radio, none of that at all. First radio I ever heard, I was in school at Richmond, and they advertised that a man from WHAS, which is the first station in Kentucky, well, I had heard that Pittsburgh KDKA in Pittsburgh. That was the first station we could ever hear. He had here in the Plains, you can hear it now. And I heard it, but they advertised that they were going to come to Richmond. Summer school was there, and there were 300 or 400 students, I guess, and put on a test to make a demonstration of how far you could carry it from Richmond to about 150 miles. And that man came, his name was Harris, I remember him well, and he hooked that thing up. There was a banister they were fixing up over in the banister, and he wouldn't let anybody come behind that banister, but I was leaning on the front row of that banister, watching what he is doing. And he is over there doing some little something. I couldn't tell what, some turning some dials, of course. What, all of a sudden she just came in. It was plain. And the first presidential race that was ever broadcast, the results, was 1924.
Mr. Johnson, we're about to run out of tape now, so we're going to have to stop. I'd like to thank you for this interview.